Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Moore. The government is the appellant in this certified case. The government may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Captain Naomi Porterfield, and I, along with Colonel Douglas P. Cordova, represent the United States in this matter. The admission of two uncontested prosecution exhibits evidencing Kelly's continued drug use leading up to trial did not constitute plain error. Now, an analysis of plain error has three essential elements.
One, a threshold question. Is there an important principle of law involved here, or is this just a case where you think the CCA got it wrong, so the government certified it?
Well, the CCA got it wrong, particularly on the point of finding that error was committed. Yes, Your Honor, this case was certified for that crucial distinction that this isn't just about a case that the government lost. This is a case where we have a published opinion that this conduct, that the admission of these documents, was plain error, when in fact it was not plain error. In fact, the military judge did not commit.
But your concern is very case specific, or is there an important principle that would pertain to all future cases, or this is something that comes up all the time in sentencing?
Well, Your Honor, I think that this is
a value neutral question, but I'm trying to identify what the big principle is here, or whether this is just a case about whether a piece of evidence should or shouldn't come in one particular case.
I think it touches on both. The main principle that will affect future cases is this construed Hardison in a way that I think was wrong. I think that the Air Force Court construed Hardison in a way that was wrong and inconsistent with the other cases that were more on point, like Norris and Shute and Ross. And so to that end, this case serves a broader purpose in that it narrows the interpretation of this court's opinion in Hardison in a way that was inconsistent with other cases. But specifically to this case, the military judge did not commit error in admitting these two prosecution exhibits. And while this court could, of course, answer this question on the issue of prejudice, as Your Honor has just pointed out, the central issue in this case, the reason it was certified, subject to the court's question, is what I'd like to focus on today. And that is that the military judge did not commit error in admitting these two prosecution exhibits. The long history of cases that involve the question of evidence and aggravation and what qualifies as directly resulting from or relating to has been consistently something that is a continuing course of conduct, and that's what we have in this case. We have evidence of a continuing course of conduct. Some of those factors include same or similar crimes. Here we have the repeated use of THC. The same victim, another factor this court has repeatedly considered. Here, that is the Air Force. And again, in this court's case, in the court's cases in Shute and Ross, the same victim. And the military can be that victim, as was the case in Shute, where the Navy was the victim, or in Ross, where the Army was the victim. Also the same period of time. Here we have five uses in a 6-month period. And there's something that the Air Force Court focuses on that is really not present in the existing case law. They talk about the fact that this was a subsequent use, the uncharged misconduct here that was admitted was subsequent to the actual charged offenses.
Counsel, if it was properly admitted as evidence in aggravation, why didn't the government argue that at trial rather than arguing that it was for rehabilitation purposes?
Well, Your Honor, once something has been admitted into evidence, the trial counsel can argue that it goes to a lack of rehabilitative potential. And her argument was very narrow to that point. I mean, it consisted of four lines in a 12.5 page argument.
But it's more the absence of a reference to evidence and aggravation, isn't it?
Well, I think the reason for that, Your Honor, if you look at the broader picture of the case, the aggravation evidence, the more significant aggravation evidence, was focused on charge two, which had to do with the dorm theft. That's where the witnesses were called. And so the majority of her argument focused on that. And that's why I think that she didn't really focus on the aggravation aspect of this particular evidence. And it just goes to show how, in relation to the other charge in this case, this evidence wasn't all that significant.
Well, the evidence doesn't fit 1001B5, does it?
It's
not testimony.
It's not,
a deposition, and it's not opinion. So how on earth does it fit in 1001B5?
Well, Your Honor, this is not something that would be offered under 1001B5 according to the specific language of 1001B5. You're correct. There's nothing in specifically in 1001B5 that talks about admitting documentary evidence specifically as evidence of rehabilitative potential or lack thereof. But there are cases that discuss the use of evidence that's in the record, admitted under some other principle, to argue or that the members can consider as lack of rehabilitative potential.
Well, are you propounding it today for rehab, or are you propounding it in aggravation, or both?
Well, the core of our argument, Your Honor, is that this evidence was properly admitted under 1001B4, aggravation evidence.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, do we have to agree with you, or do we just have to say that it was close enough that it wasn't plain error?
Well, Your Honor, what the United States would request from this court is to find that the military judge did not commit error, that this falls within the line of cases of Norse and Shute and Ross. While you could, of course, find that it wasn't plain error because it wasn't, there's no prejudice, it certainly wasn't plain or obvious given the line of cases. The United States would specifically request that this court find the military judge did not err in admitting the documents and that they were proper evidence in aggravation. And the reason for that, again, is going back to the line of cases and the continuing course of conduct that was evidenced by these two documents. And so, given the line of cases that we've already discussed in Norse and Shute, Mullins, and even Wingert, all of those cases are consistent with the facts of this case. And the Air Force Court focused its opinion on Hardison. And Hardison, of course, was highly distinguishable, as this court is well aware, because it dealt with pre-service misconduct, pre-service drug use, versus in-service drug use that took place 3.5 years later. That case was very distinguishable, and this court, in its opinion, focused on the difference in time, focused on the fact that it was pre-service versus in-service use. None of those factors were present in this case. We have a very narrow period of time. We have repeated use, what almost seems as one use per month. We have the same victim, the Air Force, in this case. And it showed the full extent of the appellee's misconduct. And that is consistent with the other cases. And so we'd ask that the court specifically clarify the application of Hardison. And distinguish it from the other cases like Norris and Shoup and Ross, clarify this published opinion from the Air Force Court to that effect so that there's no misunderstanding by the field that somehow Hardison changed the landscape of 1001B4, which the United States feels it did not. While we did discuss several other matters in our briefs dealing with the admissibility of this evidence on other grounds, today, we'd ask that you specifically find that this evidence, the admission of this evidence, was not error by the military judge. It was admissible as evidence in aggravation under 1001B4.
Counsel, turning to page 4 of the joint appendix, with reference to the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals, in the bottom, the paragraph that says, considering all above, where the court says, ultimately, the question is not whether appellant's continued use of marijuana while pending court-martial is aggravating. Certainly it is, and it has a direct impact on good order and discipline. The question is whether the subsequent uses make the former use aggravating in a way consistent with RCM 1001B4 in case precedent. We find that it does not. What in that paragraph does the government consider to be problematic in respect to the manner in which future trial judges will apply Hardison and the rule
Well, Your Honor, of course, the Air Force Court in this statement and in other parts of its opinion essentially conceded the aggravating nature of this evidence. The problem is that when they expanded Hardison to require something more than what is present in this case, that would open the door for military judges to misconstrue the current state of the law under 1001b4. Specifically, what the Air Force Court says here is that, you know, the question is whether the subsequent uses make the former aggravating in a way consistent with the limitations of 1001b4 and case precedent. Taking that sentence together with the earlier sentence, the earlier sentence in the second paragraph on page 4 of the joint appendix, while we recognize the appellee's argument that Hardison can be distinguished because of this gap, this time gap, and arguably continuous nature of the appellant's drug use, we believe these arguments ignore the remainder of the analysis in Hardison. When you take those together, what the Air Force Court seems to indicate is that the nexus that Hardison focused on, when it was talking about a nexus, it was talking about something other than it was actually talking about. The nexus in Hardison was talking about the difference in the victims, essentially. That not only was there a 3.5-year time gap, but there was also a pre-service use versus the in-service use that was charged in that case. And so there was no nexus. And the court, in reiterating that point time and again in its opinion, was not changing the landscape of 1001b4 in some way. What they were doing was talking about the absence of that connection that's always been required under 1001b4. And that connection was present in this case. So what this published opinion does is somehow leave the impression that there's something changed now because of Hardison. There's something more that's required that's simply not the case.
Can you give us the pages in the record that you cite to for where, during sentencing, the government explained how the later drug use directly related to the charged drug use? Where are those words used in offering the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, in offering the evidence, there was no further explanation. There was no objection from defense counsel, and there was no explanation about the purpose for which it was being offered.
So your objection to the CCA is that they, in the absence of anything in the record indicating why it was directly related, ruled that it was not directly related?
Well, yes, Your Honor. They ignored the fact that this was a military judge case, military judge alone case, unlike Hardison, and they really didn't talk about, they didn't really talk about that fact in their analysis, about whether the judge, you know, is given the presumption to properly assess the appropriate weight and value this evidence should be given, and as the sentencing authority in this particular case.
Was the government not free to have made the argument as to why it was directly related during the sentencing phase?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the government was free to do so, but that's certainly not a requirement. It's not something that this court has found to be necessary in analyzing whether something constitutes proper evidence in aggravation. So we would argue that in and of itself certainly wouldn't raise this to the level of error by the military judge.
Well, if that's the only error, does the case stand for the problem that you initially identified? That is, if we were to say in this case that in the absence of government argument on aggravation, in the absence of a military judge's finding on aggravation, it's not error for the Court of Criminal Appeals to find plain error in that case, what problem does that create in terms of, in a future case, the government arguing at trial under similar situations as this, that it is aggravating?
I'm sorry, sir.
In other words, if we were to simply hold in this case, and I'm not suggesting we will, it's hypothetical, if we were to hold that in light of the absence of government argument as to aggravating nature of the subsequent uses, and in the absence of the military judge's ruling as to the aggravating nature of subsequent uses, it was not error for the Court of Criminal Appeals to resolve this case on plain error. If we were to decide that, what problem does, if any, would that create for the government in future cases at trial level in arguing that a very similar case involves aggravating circumstances? That is, in that case, they would, if they set forth a specific nature of the drug use and argue that it was aggravating? And would it prevent a judge from finding that it was aggravating in those cases?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would, as a starting point, change the current state of the law in terms of what is required by the military judge to put on the record. And I see that my time has expired.
You can answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor. In terms of what the military judge or the trial counsel is required to put on the record for why the evidence is being offered and for what purpose the military judge is considering the evidence, it would also change the culpability, if you will, of the defense counsel in failing to object, because it would essentially take away the requirement for defense counsel to object if it felt that the evidence was somehow improper.
So your answer is that this case is about plain error rather than about whether aggravating evidence can be used in the future?
No, Your Honor. This case is about whether the military judge committed any error.
But if we were to resolve this on the basis I suggested rather than on the basis that this evidence is necessarily admissible, why does this create a problem for you in terms of how future cases are litigated? I understand your argument about how this may or may not create a problem with respect to plain error analysis, but how does this create a problem at the trial level?
Well, at the trial level, it would require the trial counsel and the military judge to put things on the record, and it would limit the review at that point. It would require them to put additional things on the record that would change the landscape and change the focus of how we conduct business in its current state.
Thank you. You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, may it please the court. The facts of this case and the facts of Prosecution's Exhibit 5 and Prosecution's Exhibit 6, which are found in the joint appendix beginning at pages 74, is what distinguishes why the military judge erred in admitting these documents and the Air Force Court actually correctly decided in finding the plain error. And I'd like to point out the specific references to the dates of the two-year analysis that occurred, which the government then admitted the documents for. The first test that the government admitted is related to Prosecution Exhibit 5, occurred on 18 March. The charged time frame was from December 2007 to February 2008. This test occurred on 18 March 2008. The second test occurred on, I believe, 5 May of 2008, a little over three months past the charged time frame. And that's where this case then falls more squarely into the realm of Hardison, in that this was not a continuous course of conduct. Courts have routinely treated drug use as each use of a drug as a separate and distinct offense, not as a continuing course of conduct.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that it's per se not, regardless of the interval?
No, Your Honor. I think
you seem to be saying that. Are you saying that the interval's long enough that it can't constitute such a course of conduct? Or are you saying that drug use per se isn't a continuous course of conduct?
I would say that drug use is not something that we have routinely treated as a continuing course of conduct, that each use is treated as a separate and distinct offense. And I think the very nature of the fact that we charge diverse occasions at trial, because the government is required to prove each and every distinct use of the drug, lends itself to the argument that this is not, in the terms of drug use, a continuing course of conduct.
Was Hardison decided on that basis?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
What was the rationale in Hardison?
Hardison looked at
the elapsed time, didn't they? And the fact that it was pre-service?
That is one factor that Hardison did look at, yes, Your Honor, as far as the elapsed time. While we do not have a 3.5-year gap as there was present in Hardison and pre-service or in-service. We do have a time gap between the uses, particularly when you look at the charge time frame being in February 2008, the second test occurring, that's the subject of prosecution exhibit, in May of 2008. So there is a time gap.
Does this court need to adopt your theory that you just espoused, that all drug cops are independent in order to decide the case in your favor?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe it does. And the reason why is when you look at the line of cases that discuss continuous course of conduct, there are ways to distinguish the facts of this case from how the courts have treated the continuing course of conduct analysis. For one, there was no underlying common scheme or plan that existed in this case. The government espoused no theories as to any type of underlying scheme or plan. For example,
is the problem that the government didn't present it or that it didn't exist?
There is no evidence in the record that it existed. The government basically entered these documents in a complete vacuum and provided no testimony on them.
But isn't there some significance to the fact that the charges were referred on March 14th and the trial was on May 22nd, and these two tests occurred in the interim between that while he was being prosecuted for an identical crime? And so there it seems that we have a nexus as to time, similarity, and victim. And it seems to fit into the continuing course of conduct analysis.
Because we don't know anything about the circumstances of these particular uses, any of the circumstances leading to the tests, we don't even know, other than these positive urine analysis, that even more actually ingested any type of illegal substance. We know nothing about the integrity of the chain of custody for the test.
Well, we know none of those things because no objection was made. All those things could have been tested if an objection had been made. An explanation could have been required from the government as to why the evidence was being offered. But no objection was made.
Correct, Your Honor. But that still does not allow the government to backdoor evidence that arguably the uncharged misconduct, by doing that, they're holding themselves to a lower standard of proof. And that lower standard of proof was recognized by this court in previous cases.
But then why didn't defense counsel object?
I cannot speak to why defense counsel did not object on the record. However, when you look at what the military judge had to consider before her when she decided the sentence, we have nothing to indicate that she gave these two documents any less weight than she did the witness testimony or the other documents in relation to the other charged offense, which was the larceny.
I don't think that's responsive to the question that was asked. In this case, we have the two documents admitted. We don't have before us, under the granted issue, an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. Therefore, we presume that counsel was effective in this case. Why wouldn't it be a very rational defense strategy when faced with these two documents to not object to the admission of the documents rather than object and have further information brought into play as to the specific circumstances of the drug use?
I think that's a dangerous proposition. As far as strategy-wise, we don't know, for example, would the government have the witnesses available to properly even lay the foundation to enter these documents if defense counsel had raised an objection.
But if we're presuming the effectiveness of counsel, don't we go on the presumption that there was a reason for them not to object in these circumstances?
A defense counsel, in his presentation of a sentencing case and in his sentencing argument, didn't really give us anything to hang our hats on why he failed to object to these documents.
Well, what rational reason would the defense counsel have had to say, oh, I want to bring you to your attention to these two documents I'm not going to object to so you can think even harder about continuous drug use?
But the issue then becomes when trial counsel then linked in their sentencing argument these two documents, and they did it in more than just two. Trial counsel actually.
That's not my question. My question assumes that these documents related to continuous drug use, and that the trial counsel used them for that purpose. And then the question is, why did the defense not object to the admission of these two documents? If it's not wholly irrational, why don't we just proceed on the basis that that the defense counsel was effective, they didn't object, we can readily conceive of a rational reason for not objecting, and therefore any problems with respect to the aggravating evidence were not brought out because of a defense strategy in this case.
That is one approach, Your Honor, that could be taken with
well,
it.
Well, if we take that approach, don't you lose?
I would still argue that we do not lose because of the fact that the court can still look at the lack of objection under plain error, and that's what the Air Force Court chose to do with their approach to this case. So while assumptions could be made about defense counsel's strategy or not, it still doesn't preclude any review under plain error.
But don't we know what the trial counsel's or the defense counsel's strategy was from his affidavit, where he explains why he did not object to that?
And that affidavit was secured at the lower level due to a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. But while he did so, and he says that was his strategy, he overlooked, I would argue, the damaging effects of these two documents by failing to object to them. And he went outside the bounds of...
But there you're arguing.
Now are you arguing IAC?
I'm not, because that is not the certified issue, Your Honor.
What was the material prejudice here? Judge Alone case involving stealing from a fellow airman and diverse use of a drug for which you get a BCD in 5 months.
The prejudicial effect from this case, I would argue, if you take a look at the 403 balancing test, which obviously the judge did not put on the record, and look at the probative value of the evidence versus the prejudicial effect, even with it being Judge Alone, this court has, in Winger, found that in the case of uncharged misconduct being admitted at sentencing, that even though with it being a Judge Alone case, that there still could be some prejudicial effect. A military judge is not immune to these documents before her, and I think the Air Force Court recognized that in its opinion, while it said it would be nice for the sentencing authority to be able to consider all of the evidence that it has before them, and that's referring back to the Wingert opinion, there are those limitations from 1001 that then crosses into the area of whether or not Airman Moore was prejudiced by the military judge considering these. The military judge, again, did not put anything on the record that she indicated she would not give these documents any less weight than the other evidence, despite the fact that it concerned uncharged misconduct. She did not caution counsel prior to their sentencing arguments to kind of tread lightly in their use of this evidence.
Is she required to?
She's not required to, Your Honor, but when you're looking at the circumstances of it being a military judge case, that's just something to keep in mind, that we really have nothing, we have nothing before us in the record to indicate what played a large part in how the military judge came to Airman Moore's sentence. Also turning to a little bit back to the continuing course of conduct in some of the cases, again, where the nexus is not being drawn in this case are the circumstances of the uses that surround Prosecution's Exhibit 5 and 6 that were admitted by the military judge. While this evidence may have been logically relevant, again, turning to the fact that it is the same drug, it is there is that time gap, it still doesn't make the evidence legally relevant under 1001b4 or 1001b5, as trial counsel argued.
Isn't the problem rather that it's way too relevant? Same drug, months lapse, you know, how can you argue relevance here? Isn't their argument rather that you shouldn't let it in because it's way too relevant?
That is one argument, and like I said, I'm drawing a distinction between a logical relevance, thinking of the fact that it is the same drug, versus a legal relevance where the prejudicial effect of it, and it doesn't meet the bounds of 1001b4.
Well, that's not relevance, that's something else.
In a legal context.
Go ahead.
Any further questions from this court?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Kelly talked about the fact that there was nothing on the record from the military judge to give us insight as to how she considered this evidence. Of course, that was the case given the fact that there was no defense objection, and we know why there was no defense objection from the affidavit. What we do have is a presumption that we give military judges to properly consider evidence for their appropriate weight and value. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that the military judge in this case should not receive that same presumption. This evidence, as the trial defense counsel asserted in his affidavit, was proper evidence in aggravation. It squarely falls within the continuing course of conduct that this court has long recognized.
Would the government's position in this case preclude in a different case involving the same two documents the defense from arguing that there are circumstances in the case that should preclude the admission and preclude a military judge from agreeing with the defense at the trial level on that basis?
If there were such circumstances, then an effective defense counsel would certainly raise those issues at the trial, and we would have a different record before us. So it would not preclude the same facts or the same exhibits, I should say, in a different case from leading to a different result, because we would have a different record. We would have an objection. We would have a discussion. That is, of course, not the case here. Here, what we have is the same victim, the same drug, this same period of time. We have what squarely falls as a continuing course of conduct. And if there are no further questions from the court, a complete case analysis of what constitutes proper evidence and aggravation under RCM 1001B4 makes clear that the military judge in this case did not err in admitting prosecution exhibits 5 and 6, evidencing appellee's continued drug use while on active duty pending trial. The United States urges this court to reverse the lower court's opinion as sentencing, and more importantly, to specifically find there was no error committed by the military judge in admitting these now contested exhibits.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10 minutes after 10 o'clock.
Applause.